Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2002, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this Christmas is a priest. Born in Swansea, he went from grammar school to Cambridge. He toyed with the idea of becoming a monk, but took up academic life instead. By the age of 36, he was the youngest professor at Oxford. 6 years later, he'd chucked it all in to become Bishop of Monmouth, a backwater, some said. But this clever theologian was unlikely to stay out of the limelight for long. His many books and his thoughtful views, conservative on many doctrinal matters but liberal on social issues, marked him out as a leader in his church. And so it came to pass. He became the Archbishop of Wales and then this month the 104th Archbishop of Canterbury. "It's something I've been asked to do," he says, "and I must do it with as much conviction and as much joy as I can." He is Rowan Williams. Is there a hint in that remark, Archbishop, of reluctance, do I detect? A man doing his duty?
I think it's very difficult when you're faced with any big job to see it entirely positively, because you know your own inadequacies. You know we are likely to fail. And if you've got any sense at all, you know that failing hurts. So, yes, looking at the size of the job and knowing about the failure, that's inevitable. It's difficult.
You've had time to anticipate it, and indeed, I mean, it's such a leaky system, this appointment of the Archbishop. We seem to have known, really, most of the year that you were going to be it. Did you sort of know, too?
Lots of people clearly knew a great deal more than we did at home about it. But, as I say, at the end of the day, it's something I've been asked to do. If you've been asked to do it, then, as a Christian, you believe that God gives you the resources to do it. At least without failing totally, you hope. And so, yes.
Although you have called it undoable. You have said it's a bit of a nightmare.
Huge variety of things to do and pressures. Expectations are enormous. And I think as the job has developed in the last 20 or 30 years, the international profile has been probably bigger than it was at some points in the past. And so simply in physical terms, there's an awful lot to stretch you in all directions.
And also a quite different job from anything you've done before in the sense that you are centre stage and you have to become political with a sort of medium P, don't you?
Yes, you have to understand what it is for all that you say to be picked over in a new way and to try and retain some level of spontaneity and honesty in the middle of that.
But dealing with government, I mean, talking to prime ministers,
dealing with government, yes,
speaking in the
yes.
House of Lords, will you do that?
I shall do that, yes, and I'm, in a way, rather looking forward to that, because I think that there is a vigorous debate that goes on in places like the Lords, and this country is not at the moment, I think, short of a forum for debate on substantial and basic issues. So I'm very happy to take part in that.
But there have been sessions of the House of Lords in the past where none of the 26 Lords spiritual have even been there. I think you're intending to change that a bit, aren't you?
I'd simply like to see what can be of use in that system and how we best use it.
But if you've got views, and I know you have, and I want to talk to you about them later, on whether we should go to war against Iraq, you will go to the House of Lords and stand up and say what you think.
I want to take part as best I can in that sort of discussion, yes.
There is a story, though, isn't there, of a Pope who was similarly worried, as you obviously quite rightly suggest you are, about some great issue, who, you tell me the story.
Pope John the 23rd, when he became Pope and was trying to deal with some very complicated matter, went to bed eventually and thought he'd sleep on it, woke up in the middle of the night and saying, "It's too difficult, I'll have to ask the Pope." Went back to sleep, woke up again 10 minutes later and said, "Just a minute, I am the Pope." Something of that feeling, yes. That's
absolutely
right.
But the call came and it was... I mean, is that how you see it? It's vocation. The call came.
It was a call
and
yes, you respond with, as I said, as much joy and as much enthusiasm as you can, and I look forward to it.
Tell me about your first record, because we're going to send you away to a desert island, which, you know, might be just about what you might need right now.
Ask me in a few months' time. The first record is a sort of orchestral fantasia by Vaughan Williams on the basis of a very ancient folk tune, which is also used as a hymn tune. And the hymn tune I've always loved very greatly. It's called Kingsfold in the hymn books. And one of the hymns that's been written to fit that tune I'm hoping to have at my installation in Canterbury in February.
¶¶ part of the first of Vaughan Williams' five variants on Dives and Lazarus, played by the Academy of St Martin in the Fields, conducted by Neville Mariner. And a version of that tune you're having played, you say, Archbishop, at your ceremonial investiture, as it were, in February. But you are already
right.
Earlier this month, you became the 104th
That's
Archbishop.
Right, yes. The legal formalities were completed at the beginning of this month.
That was in St Paul's.
That was in St Paul's.
And it was the legal ceremony, as you say, but there was quite a lot of ceremonial and flummery, as it were, the kind of stuff we're led to believe you don't approve of, hats and hierarchy in the Anglican Church. Hmm?
I love ceremonial when it's well done. Good ceremonial in church is ceremonial that makes you think about God, and bad ceremonial in church is ceremonial that makes you think about bishops.
So what do you want to do away with, the sort of the buttons and the hats?
I'm not campaigning to do away with anything in particular. I think it's a style that I'm concerned about. One of the things that's always appealed to me about the Eastern Orthodox Church is there's plenty of ceremonial, but very little fuss. People seem to be at home with what they're doing and to feel that it's right to be festive and, yes, perhaps to put on fancy clothes and do strange things for festivity's sake, but not a sense of anxiety with it.
An anxiety as to who is better than whom, who is higher than whom. It's that kind of
competitive. Who stands where in the
spirit.
Procession, that yes. kind of thing. And anything in worship that brings out that competitive and anxious streak, I think, is working against the basic purpose of worship.
This, of course, follows from a man who, as I said in the introduction, did once consider very seriously becoming a monk. How close did you get to it, and how old were you at the time?
This is really in my early 20s. I spent quite a bit of time in vacations from university, staying in monastic houses and saying my prayers and seeing what it felt like. And then, of course, my first actual job was in a college run by a monastic community in Yorkshire at Merfield. And so for 2 years I followed basically the rule of life of that community.
So you went on retreats and so on?
On retreat, the regular round of services during the day. And so I felt by the end of that I knew a bit of what it felt like.
And you decided it didn't
and
appeal?
And once again it was, I think, a sense of what was being asked. What was being asked of me at that time was to carry on with teaching.
Apparently a lot of women were relieved when you made this decision, I hear.
You hear, do you? I couldn't possibly comment, I'm sure. But there was, of course, one in particular that I met later on who I'm sure, I hope, is still relieved I didn't make that decision. That's my wife.
Record number two.
Record number two is the hymn Calon Lan, A Pure Heart or an Honest Heart. I grew up in an environment where we still sang hymns quite a lot. Even rather irreligious teenagers would still sing hymns at parties. My wife finds this incredible. But that at parties when we'd done our Simon and Garfunkel and Bob Dylan, we sang Welsh hymns, not because we were pious, but because that's what we knew and what we enjoyed singing.
Calon Lan, A Pure or a Guileless Heart, sung by 5,000 voices at the Royal Albert Hall, conducted by Terry James, and that was recorded in 1972. So, Archbishop, you were an only son from Swansea, as you say. Give me a picture of your childhood, if you will. What did your parents do for a living? What kind of home were you brought up in?
My father was an engineer, working for what was then the Ministry of Works, and then became the Department of the Environment, and he used to design heating and lighting systems for public buildings. He actually designed flood lighting for some of the castles in South Wales. And so it was, I suppose, a family not uncommon in South Wales at that time, the first generation away from the mines, because my father came from a mining family, my mother more from a farming family.
And your mother stayed at home because, not least because, you were quite a sickly boy, I gather.
I was rather, yes, having meningitis when I was very small.
So you stayed in bed and read your books?
I stayed in bed and read my books,
But you're a bookish chap anyway, I
think. Difficult to say, isn't it, whether I'd have been bookish without those times of enforced solitude. But I think they did matter in my development.
What did you read?
I read lots of history and lots of folklore and mythology and, I suppose, a fair bit of poetry as well.
And you went on at school to truly enjoy Latin. People always need to have this explained.
Yes, I suppose at some point I rather fell in love with the idea of other languages. And Latin, the sound of it and the discipline and the structure of it, really excited me.
And drama, you liked?
And drama, yes. I was lucky being at a school where drama was taken very seriously.
So what did you play? What kind of roles did you get given?
Oh, dear, typecasting from day one, really. I used to get authoritative sorts of roles. I ended up playing parts like the stage manager in Thornton Wilder's Our Town, who's the kind of god figure who hangs around the edges. Don't laugh.
And you played Death once,
didn't
you?
I played Death, yes, in Everyman, the miracle play, complete with a skull mask and a great big black hood.
So you had the voice. The voice we hear now has always been yours.
Well, I imagine not when I was 10, but I suppose something of it came across.
Of course, what's fascinating is the accent. Where's the Swansea accent? Was it ever there?
I don't know. I was never conscious of having and losing. And I know that when I go back to the sort of area where I grew up, some of it comes back, and that when I speak Welsh, I sound like a Swansea Valley person.
Interesting, isn't it? But there we are. We can see it all, the important elements feeding into this job that you have now arrived at, because there was the love of history, there was the love of, well, a kind of sense of theatre, really, was there.
A bit of a sense of theatre, and I suppose a love of what I can only call story and language. I think that's a very important part of religious faith and religious practice. A sense of enormous excitement about the mysteries that language can uncover for you.
Well, now, how does that all lead into this third record? You better explain this one.
Well, yes, I was never terribly keen on popular music as a teenager, but the record you're going to hear is one that was given to me as a 21st birthday present, and it's one of the Incredible String Band's records. And this particular song is one whose words I found, even then, very, very haunting. The chorus: you know all the words and you've sung all the notes, but you never quite learned the song. That seemed to me to be a very powerful summing up of the problems that people have with relationships, with life in general.
But just when everything is going fine, absolutely nothing is wrong, this funny little hedgehog's always around, and every time he wants to sing me this song. Oh, you know all the words, and yes, some all the notes, but you never quite learn the songs you sung. I can tell by the sadness in your eyes that you never quite learn the song.
The Incredible String Band and the Hedgehog Song. You might have some explaining to do after that thing. So there was no history of service in the clergy, in your family at all. Where did it come from in you, do you feel? Did you have a mentor? What inspired you?
I think it had a great deal to do with having inspirational figures around. The local vicar, Canon Eddie Hughes, who was, I suppose, the greatest single inspiration for me in my calling. He was somebody who had a very lively imagination and intelligence, who was interested in everything and everybody, read widely, encouraged me to read widely when I was a teenager, and always took absolutely seriously the questions that you asked. So you never felt stupid, and you never felt, oh, you shouldn't ask that, because he had a hospitable mind and soul.
So these are obviously, one can tell from the way that you say it, lessons that you've borne very much in mind ever since, and lessons presumably you seek to apply all of the time.
Yes, I think they've always been a kind of benchmark for me.
But how do you put it to use? Because obviously with you he was pushing at an open door, but you have, the Church of England has, does it not, a diminishing clergy, I think, you know, vast percentage drop over the past 10 years of the numbers of priests that you have. How do you encourage them in? How can you make a difference?
Well, clergy numbers, of course, have been up and down a bit, and they've actually increased here and there in recent years. So it's not all bad news. I think the willingness to be there at the end of people's questions, at the receiving end of hard questions.
If they will come to you with their questions.
Come. But that means also you've got to go out and invite those questions. And I've given very high priority in the last 10 years as a bishop in South East Wales to going around local schools.
But you can't do that as Archbishop of Canterbury. There's so much else you have to do.
There's so much else to do.
How are you going to do it?
What I've seen again in the local church in South Wales is that planting new congregations does attract people if they feel they don't have to go through a huge kind of cultural conversion to get in.
What does that mean?
If you've got a place where people sense that they're welcome, that they don't immediately have to learn a totally strange language and do totally strange things, it's surprising how many people need that, respond to that.
I still don't quite see how you're going to approach it in a different way from the way in which it's been approached before. What are you going to do to make a real difference?
more, I hope, of what I've been trying to do as a bishop in the last 10 years, which is to encourage these new enterprises, which say, don't let's unravel the parish system by any means, but see what can happen alongside it. Go and open the community centre in the council estate and see who comes. Make yourself known and trusted in an area like that. For the first time in many years recently, we saw in Wales a bit of an upturn in attendance because of these new congregations coming online.
Record number 4.
One of the bits of music that I was deeply moved by when I first heard it and still love to go back to is Monteverdi's Vespers. The basic tune is an ancient bit of plain song, very simple. And what Monteverdi does with it is to change the rhythm a little bit, so the very simple theme underlying it is played with, so that it says different things, evokes different feelings, works in different ways. That seems to me not a bad analogy for how we treat the whole basic structure of Christian belief.
Hail, bright star of heaven, Ave Maris Stella, from Monteverdi's Vespers, sung by Paul Eswood and the Louis Halsey Singers with the London Bach Orchestra, conducted by Louis Halsey. You married Rowan Williams in your early 30s to Jane, also a theologian, and essentially went into academic life, both in Oxford and Cambridge, ending up as Professor of Divinity at Oxford, age 36.
It was enormously enjoyable. But from 1980, I think, onwards, I'd also been working in a parish in Cambridge, in one of the council estates, and that's where we lived, that's where we started our married life. And that was another kind of enjoyment and another kind of stimulus. So I was sort of moonlighting, really, for a few years between this parish
and
the
university. So you were seeing what it was like outside the academic arena, as it were.
It seemed to me essential to see what was involved in trying to talk about Christianity in a not-so-comfortable environment.
To real people, you might say.
Well, I think there are real people in academies too, but certainly to see a quite different social world.
But nevertheless, generally speaking, life was very comfortable, and then when you were 42, you were offered the job as Bishop of Monmouth, and you took it.
I think I'd sensed, ever since being a curate in the estate when I was also a lecturer, that I hadn't been ordained a priest just to write books or to supervise research students.
So there was this feeling that there was a job to be done and you could make a strong contribution to it, and you had to do that.
Yes, I think the challenge was, how do I take the theology I've been talking about and writing about and make it make sense to people in Llanfihangel Gobion and Abertillery?
So that's what you went to do, and yours became, if we're following you through chronologically here, yours became a name to conjure with. And certainly there was a point in, I think, around about 97, wasn't there, when you were considered, it seems, as the Bishop of Southwark. And George Carey, then Archbishop, your predecessor, asked you, I think I'm right in saying, to distance yourself from what you'd written and said about homosexuality, about gay clergy. And you declined.
A great deal of what I think of as urban myth has grown around this period. And really, I'm slightly baffled as to where some of this has come from. I did gather that my name was considered for the Diocese of Southwark. I didn't think it right to pursue that at the time. And I must say that Archbishop Carey was never anything other than completely supportive in that period.
But this is a controversial issue, and one that I understand you would like now to put on the table, isn't it? You would like gay men and women to be acknowledged by the Anglican Church.
It's certainly no part of my programme to change this by fiat, or even to push it as a matter of discussion. But there it is on the table. We have to think about it. And my hope is simply that we think about it without too much rancour, without too much prejudice or too much fear. And that can run both ways too.
There are large tranches of the Anglican Church who do not wish to consider this at all. They are crystal clear and believe the Bible is crystal clear on the matter, don't they?
That's right. And the reason they're worried about it, I think, is largely that it comes to be an issue about the significance of the Bible and the authority of the Bible. And it's not, for many people, primarily about sex. It's about what you think of the authority of the Bible, and that is sufficiently important, I think, to justify.
But you have, I believe I'm right in saying, have you not ordained a priest whom you knew to be a practicing homosexual?
Can I take a moment?
Mm-hmm.
When bishops decide to ordain people, they take advice from all sorts of people who've been involved in selection and in training, and I've never overridden the advice I've received.
But is it something, as Archbishop of Canterbury, that you would do again?
The Church of England has a fairly clearly declared policy on this. The Church in Wales had never had a single policy document. The Church of England has, and I think I would have to abide by that policy document and would believe that was part of my job, part of my responsibility.
Record number 5.
The kind of music that speaks most deeply to me often is music that has a very contemplative quality. The music of Bach, in particular, has had a unique importance, I suppose, there. To put some of your ideas on hold, to listen to this, to go with it, that for me is a deep meditative moment and something that I need very, very urgently in a pressured life.
The opening of Bach's Solo Cello Suite No. 1 in G Major, played by Uli Turovsky. You were, Archbishop, I understand, in New York on September the 11th, 2001, and caught up in the tragedy. How close were you to the Twin Towers?
About 200 yards away, I suppose, in a neighbouring building.
What was the first that you heard or felt or knew?
The first I heard was quite literally the sound of the first aircraft hitting the tower.
I'm sure you were asked, and I'm sure you have been since, but you probably even asked on that day, really, where's God? You know, where's God when this terrible thing happened? How easy has it been to answer that question with conviction?
At one level, God is where God always is. That is at the centre of things, the absolute centre of things. Nothing changes that, nothing alters that. And then you can say, God is in the vision and the inspiration and the dedication of the people who go in compassionately, who risk their lives. And there were so many unbearably moving stories from that day of the people who had risked their lives in that way.
You, since then, have publicly criticised any kind of aggression against Afghanistan and now Iraq. I think you've been signatory to a letter saying that war against Iraq would be immoral and illegal. What happens to that argument if no action is taken and then Saddam Hussein uses biological or nuclear weapons against another great swathe of innocent people?
I think there are moments where it's inevitable that you have to meet violence with violence. I'm not an absolute pacifist, in fact.
So if a UN resolution is taken that we should go to war against Iraq, you would not oppose it at that point?
I'd have to think about the circumstances. We can say, all right, there can be what we hope would be a short surgical war. Remove a tyrant. 2 years, 3 years down the line, what have we in place? What are we envisaging? What else are we doing to secure positively the stability of the region? What positive investment are we putting in? Those larger scale questions, I think, have to be part of any calculation about what we do now.
And are these the kinds of issues that you would now expect as Archbishop of Canterbury to discuss in this way with the Prime Minister?
I'd hope there might be opportunities for that. And, again, it's a difficult balance to draw. I think I said somewhere else recently that taking the moral high ground is very easy if you don't have to take the actual decisions. Mm. And that's always the temptation.
But you could be the moral sounding board. You would want him to have this conversation with
you. You can, I think, remind people why the question's a difficult question. And I don't think it's any part of my job to pretend that questions are easier than they are.
It's your job to ask awkward questions, you could say.
It often is, I think, yes, which doesn't always make you very welcome, but I think they have to be asked.
But these are the kinds of things that you would wish to air in the House of Lords. You will be doing that, will you?
I'd hope to see that as part of my job, yes.
And you'd expect to see a packed house when you say it,
I've no idea.
I dare say it would be. Record number 6.
The Magic Flute is a very strange opera. It's all about power and violence and what overcomes power and violence. And at the same time, it just produces music that has such utter serenity that at the end of it, you've seen a story about how imagination and loyalty, love and hope simply lead people through fire and water.
Quintet from the first act of Mozart's Magic Flute with Agnes Gielsel, Anna Reynolds, Josephine Vasey, Nikolai Gedda and Walter Berry with the Philharmonia Orchestra conducted by Otto Klemperer. The other issue that we believe we know you feel very strongly about, Archbishop, is the appointment system. You don't like the fact that the Prime Minister appoints you, do you?
I think there are all kinds of historical reasons why we've got the appointment system we've got. I think it's harder to justify than perhaps it used to be. What we've seen in recent years is a gradual movement towards the church having more freedom in its recommendations.
Because, of course, the Prime Minister also chooses the bishops, technically, because they're in the House of Lords.
Technically, that's, yes, he recommends to the Queen, who was appointed. But we have now a fairly robust process within the church that allows the voice of the church to be heard in a way far clearer than would have been the case even 20 or 30 years ago. I would see that as a process that's ongoing.
What about the Queen's voice, the Crown? I mean, she is the supreme governor. You don't like that much either, do you?
Well, I think there's a much better case for the monarch's involvement than, in some ways, from the involvement of the government of the day. But I think we still have a lot of work to do defining exactly how that relationship is going to work.
I think
appropriate freedom to the church.
People will understand that you'd like to stop politicians having an influence in the church. But are these moves towards a kind of disestablishment? And it's rather like Prince Charles talking about defender of the faiths, isn't it? Are you saying this is a multicultural country? There's no religion you can call mainstream, so we really should move over?
I think there is still, in a sense, a mainstream religious tradition in the country, despite the practical plurality of religious faith in the country. For most people, it's still true that the Church of England is the church of first resort. That's where they feel they have some right to be listened to and to be looked after. And I don't think that's going to change overnight, and I don't think it should change overnight. We're learning rapidly the need to give other faith communities the right kind of public voice. We have already, as it happens, members of other faith communities in the House of Lords. I think the question is whether that ought to be some sort of statutory representation in the House of Lords. That's been discussed. We're looking at,
as long as there are bishops in the House of Lords, I mean, they may be abolished altogether when it's finally reformed.
I think it would be a big mistake to abolish the presence of religious leaders in the House of Lords. Bishops, because of the, you know, where the Church of England is in our society.
So you're saying that the Church of England should continue to be preeminent, are you, in the constitutional structure?
To the extent that that's a matter of privilege, people rightly ask awkward questions about it. to the extent that it's a matter of recognising, as the constitutions of many countries do, that the main religious body is this one. This is, as I say, the Church of First Resort. Then I don't lose too much sleep over that.
There are bumpy times to come, are there not, Archbishop?
I think it could be very interesting.
One of those words. Record number 7.
Bach's Christmas Oratorio is an overwhelming celebration of the gift of God in Jesus Christ, the essential Christmas message. So we're going to listen to one of the pieces from the Christmas Oratorio that quite specifically picks that up. Herr, dein Mitleid, Lord, your mercy, your compassion makes us free.
Herr, dein Mitleid, dein Erbarum, Lord, thy compassion, thy mercy, from Bach's Christmas Oratorio, sung by Michael George and Catherine Bott, accompanied by the New London Consort, conducted by Philip Pickett. So we begin to hear, Rowan Williams, the complexities of your new posting. On the other hand, time is on your side. You're 52.
That's
and,
right.
You could remain Archbishop of Canterbury for the next couple of decades, really, couldn't you?
It's a sobering thought, isn't it, for everybody?
You play a long game, that means. Hmm?
Well, the main priority, I think, now is to start looking towards the Lambeth Conference later this decade, the gathering of bishops from around the world and how that's to be managed. And I think I've got to keep my mind on that goal, that middle-term goal, before I start thinking about when I'm going to retire.
But you would be prepared to stay the course, would you?
I'll think about that when we've seen what the next few years look like.
Hmm. Now, if being Archbishop of Canterbury has its worries, what about being on a desert island? The soul, I'm quite sure you can take care of. What about the body?
I'm not the most practical of people, and I don't imagine that I'd be able to, well, probably not be able to light a fire, let alone build a boat. So I
would... Or a shack to live in.
Or a shack to live in, yes. Yes, even if you have fairly low expectations of your living environment, you need something over your head, and I'd have to work rather hard at that, I suspect.
But as for the solitariness, I mean, that obviously appeals, generally speaking, could prove, from everything we gather, deeply desirable in the years to come.
I'd miss my wife and children.
Mm.
But the opportunity of solitude is very important to me, and I think you have to go back to those wells and refresh yourself and become human again before God in these moments.
Tell me about your last record.
I did my doctoral research at Oxford on Russian Christianity, having for a long time had a fascination with Russian culture, Russian music, and then with the Russian church. So I've chosen as this last record some Russian music from the Compline service for Christmas Eve.
Isaiah's prophecy from the Russian Orthodox Christmas Eve service, sung by the choir of the Russian Orthodox Cathedral in London, conducted by the Reverend Archpriest Michael Fortunato. If you could only take one of those 8 records, Archbishop, which one would you take?
The Bach cello suites.
Now, we give you the Bible. Which mm-hmm. Bible would you like, by the way?
Actually, probably the authorised version. I know as a scholar it's not the most perfect translation, but it's the associations of words. It's the rhythm of the sun that I think I'd need to keep me centred.
And we give you the complete works of Shakespeare as well, and then you're allowed a book of your own choosing. What would that be?
I'd really rather like to take a book of quite tough poetry that would make me think as well as feel. Something like the collected works of W.H. Auden. Disciplined, quite complex, but full of nourishment.
And your luxury?
I was tempted to think about a regular supply of chocolate ginger, but...
Why not?
Thinking about it in the light of the music, I think I'd rather miss a piano. I wouldn't mind having a piano with me.
Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs, and happy Christmas.
And to you, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.